Robinhood bietet Ihnen Zugang zum US-Aktienmarkt. Sie können Krypto zu niedrigen Kosten kaufen und verkaufen. Alles an einem Ort. Auf Robinhood. Investment- und Kryptowertedienstleistungen für EU-Kunden werden von der Robinhood Europe UAB angeboten, die von der Zentralbank Litauens als Finanzmakler und Kryptowertedienstleister zugelassen ist und deren Aufsicht unterliegt. Termingeschäfte auf US-Aktien und ETF-Token bergen ein erhebliches Risiko und sind nicht für alle Anleger geeignet. Bitte überlegen Sie sich sorgfältig, ob Investments in derartige Finanzinstrumente mit Blick auf Ihre Erfahrung, Risikotoleranz und Finanzlage für Sie geeignet sind. Beachten Sie die geltenden Beschränkungen und Zulassungsvoraussetzungen.
All right, let's do this. How are you, what the fuckers, what the fuck buddies, what the fuck nicks? What's happening? I'm Mark Maron. This is WTF, my podcast. How's it going, huh? Right when you think it could only get worse, it does. That's a constant in the current world, the current environment, the current cultural moment, the current now. Jesus fucking Christ. Huh? I can't fucking take it, man. On top of everything else, on top of my own personal journey. I like how we use that word, journey. Hey, life is a journey, man. It's not about meeting your goals or getting everything you want. It's the journey, man. It's about the journey. Enjoy the journey. I gotta be honest with you. I think the journey's not great right now. I think that the vessel we're on, not terrific. Tough to appreciate the journey. Maybe if I'm looking back and I'm like, I can't believe our bus made it through that shit, that'll be nice. Then I could see the journey thing. But right now, on the road, on the edge, on this fucking crumbling dirt road of democracy, in a bus that's overcrowded with people that are trying to have hope, and some are crying in the back of the bus, and the sound system doesn't work, and the driver is sweating, not a great journey. There's a fucking earthquake here the other night. Yeah, on top of everything else. Happy New Year, Jews. Happy New Year to everybody who don't acknowledge that this is the Jew New Year. We've been doing the New Year thing for 5,780 some odd years, I think it is. But happy New Year to those in the tribe, those who are adjacent to the tribe. I hope the apples and honey work. It's going to take a lot of apples and honey, man. A lot of fucking apples and honey. And I know there are some people in this world that just are sort of like, hey, fuck it, man. There's not much we can do. And, you know, it was never good. And it was never going a good place. And it was always inevitable. It doesn't end it well for anybody, man. Just enjoy the ride situation. All right, I get that. But the ride stinks right now. It's a shitty amusement park. It's a fucked up, broken ride. And it doesn't look like the fucking guy is even at the controls anymore. And the guy who seems to be running the whole park is out of his fucking mind. What is it, Metaphor Day? Pow, look out. Just shit my pants, justcoffee.coop. A little throwback. I'm sorry, am I too negative? How you doing? Everything all right with the kid? Did you figure out what that thing was? Maybe you should get some more detergent then. I mean, how long are you going to put that off? I know it's scary to go to the store, but, you know, just fucking suit up and go. Suit up and go. Today we got a doubleheader, actually. We have Alicia Keys for like a half hour, and then John Leguizamo for a bit, for almost an hour. It just worked out that way. It's sort of a New Yorker, real New Yorker themed show today. They both talk like they're from the fucking city, you know? Because they are. It's, you know, I can explain it to you. Here's what happened. I had a little scheduling botch. You know, my doctor's appointment didn't show up in the calendar, and I made it months ago, and I needed to go, and it kind of cut into the Alicia Keys time a little bit, so we pushed it 15 minutes, which was fine. But then I actually got back in time, but they couldn't push it back, and she only had an hour to begin with, and then she was running 15 minutes late. So point being, we got about 30 minutes, and I was focused. Now, this is like one of those learning experiences, you know, really for me in the big picture. You know, I didn't grow up with the Alicia Keys. You know, I know the song she did with Jay-Z. I think I've heard some of her biggest hits, but it really, really wasn't in my radar. Wasn't on my radar, wasn't in my world, but I know she was great. I know she made big hits. I know she was a prodigy and a brilliant artist. I knew that, but I didn't know her stuff. So when this happens, I'm like, I think I should talk to her, but I'm going to have to get in it. I'm going to have to get into the work. So that makes me get into the work. So I listened to her past hits, some of her past records, did a little poking around in, you know, her history. But then I just focused on the new record, Alicia. So this is a record. It's been quite a few years since her last one. She's older now. She's wiser now. She's coming at it from a different angle. And I just kind of focused on that record and listened to it and listened to the words and you know, kind of absorbed where she was at and what she was talking about and kind of used that as a template. So this is like, if I ever do prepare, this is it. It's like, I take the piece of art that they've created and I see the span of their life through the lens of that piece of work. The most recent work is how I did it with this one. I don't know that I do it this way all the time, but it enabled me an immediacy to sort of connect with her. And I don't know that her and I would have talked, you know, if we ever in our lives. It almost feels like we live in different worlds. I don't know that if we did talk in another time that we would have like talked this long. So it's sort of interesting. It's a real sort of like, you know, bridge, you know, to a type of music I don't know, to an upbringing I don't know. Culturally, we're different in a lot of ways. And it was great. It was just sort of, I locked in with the work and I locked in with her. I'll share it with you, all right? Her new album, Alicia, is out now wherever you get music. And this is, listen, we lock right in. This is me and Alicia Keys.
Robinhood bietet Ihnen Zugang zum US-Aktienmarkt. Sie können Krypto zu niedrigen Kosten kaufen und verkaufen. Alles an einem Ort. Auf Robinhood. Investment- und Kryptowertedienstleistungen für EU-Kunden werden von der Robinhood Europe UAB angeboten, die von der Zentralbank Litauens als Finanzmakler und Kryptowertedienstleister zugelassen ist und deren Aufsicht unterliegt. Termingeschäfte auf US-Aktien und ETF-Token bergen ein erhebliches Risiko und sind nicht für alle Anleger geeignet. Bitte überlegen Sie sich sorgfältig, ob Investments in derartige Finanzinstrumente mit Blick auf Ihre Erfahrung, Risikotoleranz und Finanzlage für Sie geeignet sind. Beachten Sie die geltenden Beschränkungen und Zulassungsvoraussetzungen.
Hi, Alicia.
Okay. Hi, Mark. How you doing?
I'm good. How are you?
I'm great. Thank you. I'm really glad to be connecting with you.
Yeah, it's nice to talk to you. I mean, is it crazy? You're doing a million of these now?
No, I'm doing a lot of different things, but honestly, I feel great. I feel excited. I feel really in a special place right now. So I'm in my bliss.
Yeah, special place. Mm-hmm. And it took a while to get there.
It's been a long while, and so I'm just glad to be here, man.
Because I was noticing, like, it's been the last couple of records. You got about 4 years in between them, and then I was listening to the songs on this record, and I was like, wow, some shit went down.
That's so good.
I don't know what, but there's a lot of reflection. There seems to be some relationship difficulty. A little shout out to people who are the less fortunate. There's a fairly radical song about the police, but it seems like everything's covered.
Yeah, I guess so. You know, I mean, I couldn't even have guessed how this music was meant to be for this time. I mean, I feel like I've always been honored that my music is timeless.
Yeah.
But I definitely couldn't imagine how the music that I wrote, you know, even 2 years ago, a year ago, however long ago it takes to put all of it together, is relevant more than ever right now. You know, certain things are beyond your control and certain things are just how they're supposed to be. And I feel like I'm in one of those moments where it's just like everything is where it's supposed to be.
Right. Well, sadly, you know, a song like Perfect Way to Die, you know, remains forever relevant until change comes, you know?
I really can't wait because it's like, I really know that there's so many of us that don't want to see that same situation played out. We don't want to see this blatant disrespect for Black lives. And we, you know, daily, it's like a barrage of like too much and it's not right. So I really can't wait for us to collectively decide to just never do that again.
And it's interesting because like, I mean, you grew up in New York, and you grew up like in a part of New York that was rough. And it would seem to me, and I know also that you did some performing for like the Police Athletic League when you were younger, but the relationship, right, your personal relationship with the neighborhood and the police that you grew up with has got to be different than what you see right now.
I mean, to be honest, I mean, there's always been a natural distrust for police officers, sure. To be honest. I can't say we didn't grow up in a way where it was like, oh, hey, go find a police officer and ask him to help. Like, that's a whole nother neighborhood.
Right.
And I think that's the point of a lot of these conversations that we're having right now in regards to where do funds go and you know, what is actually the proper way to spend a city's funds. But it seems like there's, you know, regardless of what you know or what you experience, there's definitely two Americas. And so it feels like one side of America can approach the police and be protected by them, and another side can expect to be brutalized by them. So it's like, That's kind of what it is.
And you, where'd you grow up in New York? In Hell's Kitchen?
Hell's Kitchen and also Harlem.
Like, what was Hell's Kitchen? What was that, in the 80s?
Yeah, it was like, the 80s.
So it wasn't quite good yet, was it?
No, it was way far from being good. It was nasty. It's definitely, I mean, I like to say that it's like the place where all the misfits and the outcasts and the unwanted ones were congregating. And
we between 9th and 10th?
Yeah, I was actually right on 10th. That was like right there.
It's
West
like
Side
the
highway.
Yeah, like the city just sort of drops off there. It's like the edge of civilization, right?
Especially because it was before, like now there's all these cool things on the piers and there's all these places and there's like stuff to do. But at that time it was desolate. Like it was not, you didn't dare go to the pier. That was not the place where you went. Not if you wanted to come back.
Right.
So it's so interesting how things evolve and everything. But yeah, that's what it was.
And it was like, was it just you and your mom?
Yeah, I mean, my mother is an amazing woman, single mother. She raised me.
Yeah.
She chose to have me and chose to fight for me. And she's, you know, incredible. Still my best friend to this day.
So like growing up in that neighborhood, I mean, do you have siblings?
I have a brother, but he didn't grow up with me in that neighborhood. I'm my mother's only child.
Oh, I'll get it. I get it. Do you have a relationship with that guy?
My brother?
Yeah.
Yes. Oh, my God. He's my like baby. I love him. He's 10 years younger than me, so we have like a really beautiful brother sister vibe, but it's like he's almost like my first kid in a way.
Yeah.
You know, so there's like a real love and protection there. But now he's all taller than me, so I'm like his little sister now and he's my big brother and whatever.
Yeah. So like when you started getting into music, was it primarily to avoid the danger of that neighborhood?
I think, you know, when I got into music, when I first got into music, it was because I was definitely drawn. I was drawn to the piano in almost like a spiritual way that I don't even exactly know why or what made me it call me.
Yeah.
So it definitely called me from a young age. Even before I could play, I knew I wanted to play, even though I couldn't play. I wanted to, and so.
Where'd you first see it? Where do you remember first seeing, like, you know, that's what I gotta, look at that.
Yeah, I remember, like, walking down the street and passing piano stores, you know, like in New York, and, you know, and I would just be fascinated, like, and I just put my nose to the window and look at it and just be, like, I want to go in there and play, but I didn't know how to play. So what was I going to go in there and do? But I just knew I wanted to. And it was that type of energy. My grandmother, my mother's mother, played piano. And that was cool because when she would come stay with me, if my mother had to go away, we would practice piano together. And she definitely had a vibe like that. Other than that, there wasn't really anybody that played piano around me like that. My mother wasn't a very, you know, musician. She was an actor, but she wasn't a musician. But there was always creative energy around me all the time. And so I think I was always just kind of like taken in by that creative spirit and spark.
What was the music in the house?
music in the house was, you know, a lot of jazz, a lot of kind of Ella Fitzgerald, a lot of Bobby Caldwell, definitely some Miles Davis. And there was a lot of, you know, Aretha Franklin's and Etta James and Marvin Gaye's, the classics, all the classics.
So you had that going, and you know, you knew that that's a pretty good range of stuff. And it was like, if you were to sort of explain where you're coming from, I'd say, you know, most of those are it, right?
Yeah. And then I think, and then obviously in my, you know, and then I was introduced from the streets and from my friends to Nas and Wu-Tang and Biggie Smalls and Tupac and all of that influence was like my secondary, my other ether. And so it was kind of this mix between soul and then I was playing classical music. So I was playing Chopin and Satie and Debussy. And so it was this mixture between soul and classical and hip hop.
Can you listen to classical now?
Oh my God, so much.
Really?
And I love it. I love it.
I don't understand. It's like the only music that I don't get. I mean, I understand it's beautiful.
I think when we finish this conversation, you should listen to Debussy.
Okay. I will.
And that will give you a vibe. Because there's plenty of classical music, plenty of classical arrangements and music that I cannot listen to. It's too like hippity-hippity.
Yeah.
And I don't want to hear that type. But when I'm hearing like this very soulful, moody, bluesy, dark chords, and it's like gorgeous and the arrangements are unbelievable, I am like, my mind is blown. So it's definitely, I would say go for Debussy after this. Thank you.
But you like when you studied it, do you get the whole, because like, I don't even know how it works as a, like, I don't know how a symphony works. I don't know what movements are. I don't know, you know, why it fits together. Do you?
Yeah, I think that's, I do. And I studied it. And so I think that's a really, I'm really proud of that part of my, you know, my upbringing. I think that it really gave me another perspective that a lot of people don't get a chance to explore and experience. And even with sight reading and even with just knowing how to read notes, period. Like that's a big reason why I can arrange and why I can hear voicings in my head in a way that I think other people can't. But I think movements are the most beautiful. One of my favorite, it's very, very popular, but one of my favorite Chopin songs, because Chopin is one of my favorites too, is called The Raindrop Prelude. You've heard it before without question. But the second movement is actually, to me, the most beautiful because it feels like the thunder. And the more dark and bluesy for me, I'm like, put me in a mood, get me in my emotions, I'm all in. So it feels like the thunder and you can hear how it's cracking and growing and all of that. And so that's one of my favorites. So I love how movements go together and that there's actually a thought behind why it evolves the song.
And like, I imagine in order to learn how to do that, you obviously had a gift for it, but you were very young when you started playing the piano. But the discipline it takes to do that and to get locked into that and the sort of, it's almost, I remember who I talked to about the military and about how his experience in the military defined how he approached work in general. You know, you could see it programmed his brain. So I imagine that discipline must have been laid that wiring for you to get shit done.
You know what? That's absolutely right. I mean, there was a certain level of discipline that comes with classical music that just doesn't come with anything else. You just can't pretend to play classical music. You just have to study it. You have to work at it. You have to break it down. Each measure has to be broken down. The complexities are, you're using sides of your brain that don't even usually go together. It's definitely like an experience that I'm grateful also that. Of course, when I was a kid, I was like, y'all get off my back. Like, why do I have to practice this stuff? But the effort and the discipline of learning how to put in work is, you know, priceless. I mean, nobody can outwork me because I understand what it means to put in work. Like, and I'm not afraid to put in work. I'm also learning that I also have to take breaks and you have to be healthy and you can't like burn yourself to the ground because that's not going to work either.
When did you learn that? When you were 10?
I know how to work. No, I didn't learn that for a long, long time. Probably when I had my first kid, then I was like, oh, you know, somebody's more important than me. So I have to, you know, pay attention.
Well, that's nice that you recognize that as a mother. Yeah. Some mothers don't.
Yeah. It's definitely, I mean, once you got that little being in your hand, you're like, I cannot believe this being needs me for everything. It's
everything.
Humbling.
How many you got? You have two?
Yeah, I have two. My husband has three before me. And we have two together, so we have five all together. So I am definitely it's so cool for me because I get to see the spectrum. Like, you know, our kids are 5 and 9,
yeah.
But I get to see like what happens when they're 13, what happens when they're 19. It's like a thing. So I feel like it teaches me a lot for what, you know, what's going to come and how I want to keep open, you know, yeah, about it all.
Well, in terms of like the work, like I imagine that understanding classical music, because you seem to collaborate with a lot of people and you seem to do it well, which is sort of a unique thing and sort of a gift. And I guess as an arranger on this record, you collaborated with a few people, eh?
Yeah. You know, I used to absolutely be so frightened of collaboration because it's so, you know, like exposing. You get exposed, all your things and idiosyncrasies, yeah, and the way that you feel. It's like you have to be so honest. So sometimes you don't want to be honest with a lot of people. But
and what if you're a monster one day? Then all those people know.
Yeah. You know? I mean, but that's the thing. I never met my monster until recently. And so I always hid my monster, and now I've truly learned how to let my monster out. It's a good thing.
Yeah.
A good thing. But collaboration, so I enjoy collaborating. I on this album, I love collaborating with Johnny McDade. He's a really, really amazing writer and producer and person who could just, honestly, I just call him my therapist because we sit in a room and he'll ask me questions and no one will take the time to ask me or think about. And so what that brings forth is really, really powerful. I really enjoyed writing with a gentleman named Sebastian Cole. We wrote Time Machine together and also Perfect Way to Die. And he's very prolific. I think he's one of the most powerful writers that I know. I also enjoyed working with The Dream. He's somebody that I hadn't worked with before, but I've always known of him. And yeah, when we got together, he has like a certain magic to him and like just energy to him that's, you know, that's invigorating. So it's cool because nobody's going to come up with what I'm going to come up with. And I'm never going to come up with what they come up with. So when we put it together, it's like kind of fascinating.
Yeah. And they're ultimately working to honor your voice and your vision. So whatever they bring, you know, it's only going to, you know, broaden your trip, you know?
Yeah, it enhances. Absolutely. Yeah. For sure. 100%.
So when you were younger, was there ever a time, because I mean, you had big hits right away. It's interesting. I was looking at some research that, you know, because Aretha Franklin left Columbia too to go to Atlantic. Right. For a similar reason.
That's the reason why I didn't feel so bad.
That's why you didn't feel so bad?
Yeah. Once I found out that they messed up with Aretha, like Columbia definitely, you know, just didn't know what they had in me. And I can't blame them because I'm an anomaly and I'm definitely something that can't be defined. And so, you know, business people don't like things that can't be defined.
No, they want to put you in a box.
Antithesis of commercial. Yeah. Right.
Right. Right.
So I don't blame them. But once I found out that they didn't know what they had in Aretha Franklin too, I was like, oh, they're just stupid.
Yeah. And she did like 10 records with them.
Crazy how long she was there.
It's crazy. And then Jerry Wexler took her over at Atlantic and that was it.
Man, and that was it. They found their match. And that's all it's about, you know, finding your match, finding where you belong.
Yeah. I just played Jerry Wexler in a movie with Jennifer Hudson in that Aretha.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah. So I was with Jennifer. The new
which
one.
Which movie?
It hasn't come out yet. Aretha Franklin movie. Respect.
And man.
Jennifer plays Aretha.
So good. That's going to be so good. You know what? I can see that.
Yeah.
I can totally see that. You can completely be that.
be a cranky Jew? Yeah, I can.
Is that what you are?
Sometimes.
Right?
I have my monster as well. And I've known my monster for a very long time.
Now, when's the first time you met your monster?
I was probably like 19.
So that was the first time you let it out?
Yeah, I didn't know I didn't know what he was up to, but you know, I was in my first real relationship, and you know, when you love somebody and you're not used to being vulnerable, you know, sometimes that's when the monster happens.
Because it's scary. Like, you have to protect yourself by all costs. Like, you're not gonna hurt me. I gotta protect myself.
That's right.
This is crazy.
Yeah.
I get it.
When did you meet your monster?
Well, I only met my monster recently, as I told you, because I, you know, in a lot of ways, I think I've always been kind of the level-headed one.
Yeah.
And so it's always been my mother and I. So yeah. She was always kind of quite wearing all her emotions on her sleeve. Mm. And so I always had to be kind of the rational one and the
control.
One that made it all make sense and like figure it out and calm it down and that type of thing. So I learned very early how to be very accommodating and pacifying, which is a shame. But
right, because it doesn't enable you to have your own feelings or to define your own personness.
I think so. I think it definitely made me very accustomed to and comfortable with being accommodating and pacifying, and that took a while to unwind.
Oh yeah.
So finally, when I started to unwind that, because I always had to be the accommodating one, and always had to be the pacifying one, I always had to be the one that made it okay and the one that made it better and all that shit. Finally, after I unwound that, I was like, okay, look, I can't fix everything and I can't fix your shit. And look, I can fix mine. I'm gonna try, but I definitely am gonna have to focus on that. And also just like taking off that weight to feel like you gotta put everything together.
Well, it's a relief, because I think that's pretty much the classic kind of codependency thing, right? Where you just feel like you can, you're there to help somebody else. You almost lose yourself. In trying to help other people,
everybody else.
And then one day you just spin out, right? You just like,
right? Like, I'm over it.
Yeah,
I'm not doing this anymore. I'm not doing it anymore. But it's good because you got to get to that place, I think.
Yeah, to know that some things are just you're powerless over them. You can't control it. You can't fix it. Fuck it.
Yeah, you could give it up. Just give it up. Leave it alone. Just leave it alone.
So that's what that song is. I'm done. So done.
I'm so done. Yes, yes. I'm done guarding my tongue, holding me back. I'm living the way that I want. I'm done fighting myself, going through hell. I'm living the way that I want. Like, cut it
finally
out. Just be done. Oh, it feels so good. Just like that song feels good. It feels good.
Well, but like outside of relationships, I imagine like from the beginning, once you started doing that first record, once you moved over with, like, who are you with? Clive Davis, right? You know?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And you started making those hits and putting all that work in, that you must have been like just submerged with that personality, just in the work. And you're just churning out the music all the time. You probably, did you have a life when you were younger?
Oh, no, I didn't know. I mean, you know, everything happened for me very young.
Right.
So, which is amazing and a beautiful blessing.
Right.
But it's also kind of crazy to have to manage everything and figure everything out and keep it all kind of spinning. You know, from about 18 until today. So I definitely didn't really have a traditional teenage experience. I didn't have a traditional young adult experience. And a lot of the times it's interesting for me when I think back on that. But I feel very normal, and I'm really good. I think I'm more normal than people that probably had those traditional experiences. And maybe in some way I was able to, you know, thanks to my mother, I think, because she's very much a realist. And she always kept me very grounded.
And also thanks to New York City. I mean, New York City, you know, that's solid. You know what I mean? Like, you know, New York City is almost like when you grow up there and you spend that life there, it's almost apparent in a way. There's something about the personality in New York.
You are so right, because I think the first time that I really, you know, came in contact with making a lot of choices for myself, and especially under the scrutiny of people or whatever, or pressure of whatever, I knew what I didn't want right away. And I knew I didn't want it because of New York. I was like, I don't know about all these other things.
Yeah.
But what I know is that I'm not going to be doing this. And that was helpful. It really did. It did parent me in a lot of ways.
Yeah. And I think, like, you know, especially, you know, with the huge song, I mean, you know, Empire State of Mind, it's almost replaced New York, New York as the song for New York. You guys did it.
No, that's crazy. No, I mean, that's literally crazy, and we're super proud of it. And we always look at each other like, what? Like, yeah. Seriously?
But like, it seems like, but you're like a lot of these songs, it's very hard for me to, on the new record, I mean, I'll just stay with that. Like, it seems like the underdog song is sort of a, almost like an anthem out of respect for, you know, people that struggle and, you know, from what, in some ways, a little bit what you came from, maybe.
A lot of what I came from. I mean, I definitely defy the odds. My mother defied the odds for sure.
Yeah.
Without question. So there's no question that that's our life. And it's also the hundreds and thousands of other people that, you know, are not expected to be able to make it out of whatever situation or circumstance they're in currently. And I think, you know, we all have that possibility,
sure.
You know? So it's definitely, yeah. That's why that song is so, the song is actually really about like when you meet people and you don't know them, and how do you actually open yourself to, do we actually see each other, or do we kind of just pass each other in our busyness? Do we know our story, each other's stories, or do we just kind of like, you know,
well,
are so ingratiated in our world?
Well, that's sort of like in a few of the songs, like Gramercy Park, like two a little bit, right?
Gramercy Park is one of my favorites, like one of my favorite songs
I love
ever
that
wrote.
Groove on there, and that, like, it's really kind of an intimate song. It's not, you know, it's a little more, it feels personal, like the instrumentation feels very sort of candid, and you know what I mean? Like,
it's definitely very raw, very stripped back.
Yeah, yeah.
Totally, like, you know, folksy, and
yeah,
I love that about it. But I love, most importantly, is like, about the way that you change yourself unknowingly because you love somebody, thinking that you're doing it out of love, but only to find out that you've lost yourself in the
right
process.
Right, because that's what I was saying when I heard it. I was like, because there's a line in there where it's sort of like, you know, you fell in love with somebody like you don't even know, really, or something like something along those lines, right?
It's like, now you've fallen for a person that's not even me, because I forgot about the person that I used to be.
Oh my God, did you? Is everything okay with your husband? What's going on?
That is, you know, honestly, I find that me and my husband are amazing. I think that I find that happens with my friends
and
different relationships that I've had in the past
where
I wasn't so solid, or I didn't really understand how to be clearly myself. I was like more of a shapeshifter because, you know, I was just learning.
Yeah, I was wondering about that. And truth without love is a lie. Where'd that come from?
I love that. I mean, that's one of my favorite songs.
It's a nice, it's like the phrase, like, I can't stop thinking about, you know, the poetry of it.
Yeah, I mean, I think that it means a lot of things to a lot of people under different circumstances. But for me, I feel like you can have all the truth in the world, and you can be spitting all the truth in the world, but if you are not saying it with love, how does that person receive it? Is it actually the truth, or is it just a lie? So it's like, I think there's such a power in that poetry. You're right. And you know, you know, it's like this honest delivery in that song that I love.
Yeah. And you can also use like truth as a weapon. Sometimes, you know, not saying something is more loving than saying something.
That's true. That is true.
But I think it's interesting you say that you didn't know like who you were, how to hold on to yourself throughout a lot of what you were doing. Because like, I feel that on this record when I listen to the other records, that, you know, your voice is in the cradle of yourself now. You know what I mean?
Yes.
Like, I mean, you have a great voice. You've always had a great voice, but now you feel some wisdom, and now, like, you know, you're connecting to that wisdom and to, you know, to your heart. You know, you're not, you know what I mean? It you can definitely feel the weight of it now.
I also realize that I don't have to try so hard. I think sometimes, you know, you try so hard to like hit the thing or sing it strong or do this impressive whatever. And it's like, at some point you could actually just speak your truth and just say what you feel, and you can deliver it in so many different ways. And there's not just one way to be great. And I think that, you know, that's some of the stereotype, and we have to break down as humans, because we think, man, I'm only great if I so it's cool to be able to not have to try so hard,
right? And sometimes, like, if you're one of those people that never thinks you're doing good enough, there's no end to that, and you're just gonna, you know, burn yourself out, right? You'll never be happy.
You're right. You do have to recognize what's special about you, you know,
which right. I and think also is- just be like, That was good, you know, like, I did all right. Here's the thing I always do is sort of like, I've been doing this a long fucking time. So like, right. So like, you know, whatever I think about it, I know how to do this. So like, I don't have to beat myself up thinking I don't know how to do stand up or whatever the hell I do. Right.
Right.
So I, and then you can relax a little bit and at least enjoy what you do.
You know, and I, strangely enough, I have a kind of an opposite feeling. I feel like every time I do what I do, I don't know what I'm doing. And really? I actually, I mean, of course, I know I've done it before, but I don't exactly know how it's going to come to fruition this time. You know,
and that's okay though. But yeah,
I'm
the process.
Cool with that. Whereas yeah. before, I think I felt like I had to know or I had to be able to be in control. And was it going to be good enough? And what if it wasn't good? I worry less about that now.
But you know you have the skill set. You may not know how the piece is going to unfold, but you know I can play piano, I can sing, I can work with these people, yeah. I can write the song. We don't know what's going to happen, but
I know
the craft
it's gonna
is
happen.
In place.
Yes, yes. I definitely put in my 40,000 hours, so feel
yeah.
good about that.
I'll say. Well, look, I know you got to go. Maybe we can pick it up again. It was great talking to you. I love the record.
Hey, man. Thank you so much. I'm so glad to talk to you. Thank you for thinking about it, being putting your mind on it and connecting with me and all the good things. I can't wait to talk to you again.
Okay, good. Take care. Good luck with the record.
Thank you, man. Talk to you later.
That was fun, right? We locked in. I liked her a lot, and I liked the new record. Her new record, Alicia, is out now wherever you get your music. So, here's an upbeat thing. Before we get to John Leguizamo, I've changed my opinion. I've changed a long-held opinion. And I'll share it with you. And it was not a great opinion, but I didn't... Years ago, when I saw Robert Altman's Long Goodbye with Elliot Gould... I didn't think it worked. Yeah, granted, as time went on, I realized I was the only one that thought that. And I love Altman. He made one of my favorite movies of all time, McCabe and Mrs. Miller. But I just couldn't lock into The Long Goodbye. And for some reason last night, I don't know how I got there, I ended up watching One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, which, you know, I don't know if you've read that book by Ken Kesey. The book is genius. It's written from the point of view of Chief. But the movie's pretty fucking great, too. In that last scene... where Chief's like, I'm going to take you with me. You know, it's like, wow. All right. But then I got from there somehow to The Long Goodbye, and it was fucking great. Elliot Gould was great, just turning that form, the Private Dick movie, on its head in that 70s way. Sterling Hayden. I mean, it's just like I was completely flabbergasted at my younger self for being such a dummy. Do yourself a favor and watch The Long Goodbye. I think it's on Amazon Prime is where I watched it. And of course, Cuckoo's Nest, if you haven't seen that lately. They're working you like they worked my father. The Combine, that's in the book. Anyway, look, John Leguizamo is somebody I never really met, though he claims we did, but I don't, it's all right. I'm surprised I didn't. I used to be on the Lower East Side a bit, and yeah, I knew he'd come from there at some point. Anyways, it just, it hasn't happened. We haven't met, we haven't talked, and I didn't know how it would go. But he's got this new movie called Critical Thinking that he stars in and he directed. And you can watch it on most video on demand platforms. And he put his heart into it. And he puts his heart into all his stuff that he's doing in terms of, like, especially his solo shows. And I was happy that the conversation went well. This is me talking to John Leguizamo. Sideways. That's interesting.
It'll come around. I was like, give it a moment. You're high maintenance.
Yeah, I'm high maintenance. Me? Where are you? Are you in New York?
I'm in Manny Hattie.
Oh yeah.
Yeah.
I see you. You got your Emmy behind you. Is that an Emmy?
Yeah. Subliminal. Yeah.
What? That's for Freak.
Yeah, that was for Freak.
Yeah. So
my Tony's upstairs.
How many? You got one of those or two of those?
I got only one of those.
Uh-huh. Well, you got to get it up there. You got to get up there next to the other statue.
No, I spread it around, so I boost myself on every floor.
Oh, okay. Yeah, yeah. So, like, every room you walk into, you're like, look what I
There's
did.
There's a little something. There's a little tribute to to my achievements.
I'm winning. Look at now that I can't leave my house for very long. It's nice to see because, what I've won.
Yeah, my self-esteem starts to drop quickly.
But believe me, it's kind of true, isn't it? It's weird that, you know, when you're kind of isolated and you can't really do anything, even walk down the street to at least get someone stranger to go, "Hey, man, I love your shit." You're just walking
around.
Hey,
John. Yeah. Hey, Johnny. That's how I get in New York all the time. Hey, Johnny.
But that feels good. And if you don't get that little boost on a day-to-day basis, you walk around your house thinking like, who the fuck am I? Did I do anything?
You know, but you know better than to Google yourself. You know,
no, I never do that.
That sucker. Woo!
I don't do
that. You do
that
once, you'll never do it again, because like the first 10 or 15 are like, you're incredible. I love you. You're amazing. Yeah. Then after that, it's like, you suck. You're the worst. You're piece of shit. You're fake. You're like, what?
Yeah.
It's like a
horrendous speedball. Like you're up. And then you get knocked down. You're like, oh, fuck. And then you're up again and you're down. Yeah. I don't do it.
I love the analogy.
Yeah. Well, that's what it is, really, except that one side is terrible. I mean, I think at least with the speedball, both sides are different, but they're both good.
Right. No. Google. I mean, you Google yourself after that first, you know, it gets really dark, very dark. Anonymity is a strange drug for people.
Yeah.
It's not the social media so much. It's the feeling that they don't, because they wouldn't say that to your face.
Right. Of course not.
None of them would come up to you. Even if they're bigger than you and they could beat you, they still wouldn't come up to your face and say that.
Yeah.
But anonymously, they feel like, well, you'll never know. I could say this and that.
And you know what, though? You know what I realize, though, is a lot of them, it's their fucking hobby, man. It might not even be how they feel. They're just choosing with you. They're trying to get to react. This is like their
game.
You know,
they get off on that. They get off on that. Yeah.
That's the
negativity monsters. Yeah, yeah.
The definition of trolling is to poke at you until they hit your fucking sensitivity and you react. As soon as you go, fuck you, they're like, dude,
they got you.
I did
right,
it.
Right. Woo, real man. He got me.
Got him. Yeah, and if you fucking get into it with him, I used to, like, way back in the day, you find yourself, like, spending 20 minutes on Twitter arguing with a guy with no picture, no name, and four followers, and you're like, what the fuck is wrong with me?
You lost half an hour of your life that you can't get back.
I know,
and then
man.
people stop being on your side, too, because they feel like you're being mean or something.
Yeah, yeah. Why are you beating up on the guy with no friends?
Yeah, yeah. With no followers.
No, it's not even a real person. So, like, we've never met before, I don't think, have we?
Yeah, we have. It's okay. You don't have to remember me. It's fine. It happens.
No, I remember you. I know you. But where do
no,
we
you
meet?
No, you don't remember me.
Where was
it? Well, yeah, I know you, but where?
No, yeah, where?
Emmys. Remember, we were at the Emmy party together a couple times.
Oh. I've only been to the Emmys once. One time.
Then how come I remember? I've been there a lot of times. How come I remember you?
Because I make an impression, John. You already made an impression.
It must be you. It must be your charisma.
Yeah, exactly. No, but yeah. I mean, like, of course I know you, but I we were in New York at the same time. I never met you when we were kids. I was down. I was in New York. I was on the Lower East Side, 89 to 92, and then at 16th.
I was there a lot.
Yeah, and then I was at 16th and 3rd from, like, you know, 93 at night to 95, then out in Astoria forever. But I knew you were around, right? Weren't you a Lower East Side guy?
Oh yeah. I was LES. You know, obviously I'm from Jackson Heights, Queens. That's where I'm from. But you know, I made my mark was in LES. You know, all the performance arts spaces downtown. And I lived on Staten and Ridge. Then I lived on 7th and C&D.
That's
for
it.
A long, long time.
You remember Hammerhead?
Oh yeah. do you remember? Later on the game, do you remember Zoom Schneider, that crazy bar?
Where was it?
Esperanto, you remember? That was later. That was like in the late 90s, early 2000s.
Oh,
when it started to gentrify. Oh, you're talking about Save the Robots. You're talking about Save the Robots. You're talking about...
I lived on second between A and B, right by that weird sculpture.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
The garage. That was the garage.
89.
I performed there. That was a performance space.
Right. So
I did Spikorama there.
You did to start at the beginning?
Yeah, I started there, yeah.
So you grew up in Jackson Heights till at what age?
What do you mean, until what age? Like I lived like till college, and then I left.
Oh, and then, but you didn't, but you lived on the, you, oh, when you went to college, you moved into the city.
Right. Well, I lived I was at CW Post first for 2 years, then transferred to NYU, then I lived with my brother at Columbia because I had no money.
How many brothers and sisters you got? Just one?
Well, I have one full brother, two stepsisters, three half brothers and sisters.
Oh my God. Big family.
My father couldn't focus.
If he could, just on different things.
Yeah. A little sexual ADHD.
Yeah. You'll work for now. So, like, when did you start, when did you start doing the performing? I mean, I'm trying to get a timeline.
Mid-80s. So I was at the First Amendment Improv Company on Bond Street. You know, like everybody was performing there, but except when I got there, it was on the downhill.
When the fuck was that? In the mid-80s?
Yeah.
I don't like, because that was before I got
Bruce
there.
Bruce Willis was coming down. Robin Williams was coming down. Everybody. But when I got there, they stopped coming.
I don't remember that place at all. Maybe I, like, because I was all stand-up, so I didn't know nothing about.
Oh, that was the improv circuit.
Yeah.
And then I was at Gusto House, Avenue A. And like 6th Street, I was at Knitting Factory, Dixon Place,
yeah.
La Cucaracha,
yeah.
Home. You know, these are all the performance arts spaces. Because I was doing the clubs too, like the open mic night at Catch a Rising Star Mondays. You know, get the lottery and whatnot at Comic Strip, Ronnie Dangerfield.
You were going to try those. You did those, the Dangerfields, Catch a Rising Star, Comic Strip.
I didn't like it as much.
How old were you? Like 19, 20?
20.
So now when you did stand up, because that's my world, I don't think I ever saw you around.
I'm sorry,
but
I need to put down your world.
No, I don't care.
you don't give a shit what I say.
No, I mean, you can put down my world, but we got rid of you. You couldn't hack it. We got rid of you. You didn't stay in our world. You went to the other.
It was not my world. It was like, I felt like a fish out of water. I was like, it's set up. Punchline, all these drunk motherfuckers. I'm like, I can't perform for you.
What were you doing when you did stand up? Were you doing characters?
Right. I was doing characters and stories. And then my girlfriend at the time, we used to do sketch comedy and improv. Obviously, we travel around everywhere and do improv with different improv groups. But I found myself was doing my 30-minute little monologues full of characters. Like if the Bible, if Jesus were Latin, if the West had been won by Latin people instead of lost. And, you know, I would do those kind of things and people dug it. So I was like, this is my thing.
So not my thing. Because you would do that stuff and they wouldn't get on board. They couldn't follow it. It took too long.
Too set up-y.
Yeah.
They just want a quick little quickie.
Yeah. Punch
and I was
it
like,
out.
Nah, you gotta earn me.
So it's right. So at age 20, you're like, fuck stand up, going back downtown and just digging in. And were you taking classes at the time?
Yeah, I was taking acting classes since I was 17 with some of the greats. I was always the only Latin guy. And these teachers were so beautiful and mentoring. And they knew they boosted me. You know, they knew they needed to help me out. And Herbert Berghoff, who owned HB Studios, I was in his class for a couple of years. Lee Strasberg for a little bit.
You were around when Lee was alive?
I was in his class one day, his last day on earth.
Come on.
At Lee Strasberg Institute on 15th Street. I did a sense memory exercise of something from my childhood, and he died that night because of my acting. I'm pretty sure.
So that
it's
that
not
just,
proven.
That just that just made you
evidence,
work harder.
But I'm pretty sure it was my acting that killed him.
Really? You were in his class when he passed away. He was old, wasn't he old?
Oh, very, very, very. He had like a click in his throat, like he'd go around, and I wanted to try to do that a little better than that. Okay. And they're like that very quiet, you could hardly hear him, and they had that clicky thing.
Right, but at that age, I took classes from a guy named Michael Howard in New York.
Oh yeah, famous, yeah. Legendary.
But like, They get to a certain age, and you know, are you finding that you were there because you wanted to be around the guy and his history, or you're actually learning something?
No, I learned. I feel like my acting totally changed. I mean, I love HB Studios. I learned a lot about scene study and scene breakdown and motivation, previous circumstances. I'm gonna get mad acting nerd with you now.
Okay.
And then with Strasberg, it was more about imagination. It's what made me do my one-man shows, because you learned how to create an environment imaginarily, talk to imaginary people, you know, you created that all from your imagination. So I never felt alone on Broadway because I had my imagination and it was vivid to me.
So he freed that.
Because of the method.
Right.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yep.
When you developed the first show, which was that?
Mamba Mouth, 1990.
1990.
You were... Oh, you don't believe me, motherfucker. He's like, nah, I know you weren't.
But where did you work that out?
I worked out everywhere. Home, Dixon Place.
What was the woman's name who owned Dixon Place?
Ellie Kovan.
And who were the guys? It was so weird that by the 90s, you know, I was locked into stand-up, but there was still what was left of the performance art scene from the 80s. But then there were new people Surf Reality, Collective right. Unconscious. There was all these new yep. kind of venues. But you kind of got the tail end of the original crew. So, did Bogosian come up with you, or he's a little before you?
Yep, PS-122, that was Bogosian right there. He was a little before me, because obviously he's one of my mentors, you know, one of the people that inspired me.
Yeah.
But he was right before me.
So did you see, what made you realize that you could do these, because the one-person show thing is, it's a blessing and a curse.
Ain't no curse. there ain't no curse to it.
No, I mean, there were guys.
What do you mean? No, you got to explain yourself.
I'm talking as a stand-up comic who was out there hammering it out and figured it out in front of fucking strangers who didn't give a fuck. All right, now, but wait, no, just hang out. There, I'm just saying that.
Where am I going? I got another book.
Not unlike stand-up, there's some people that are really good at it, and then there's a lot of people that did some really bad one-man shows. That's all I'm saying.
Oh, no doubt. Yeah,
it gave people a false sense of hope for their future in theater. That's what I'm saying.
Yeah, no, there were definitely a lot of bad one-man shows. But, you know, before our generation, my generation,
yeah,
it was always like, you know, one-man shows were Samuel Clemens, not even Mark Twain, Samuel Clemens, yeah. Young Abe Lincoln. You know, it was all those like very literary bios, you know what I mean? And then it got funkier.
Right. But there was a difference between like what Spalding Gray was doing and what you were doing. Right. There definitely became a point where, because you and Bogosian, where people were like, I'm going to do a parade of characters. Like, you know, it seemed like Spalding was more like Mark Twain, where he would focus in on an essay and, you know, and in his manic sense, you know, present this thing.
In a very raw, naked way, which was the beauty of him.
Well, he's so good.
There was no filter. There was no pretense or trying to like shape it to make it more palatable. And then you got Eric Bogosian brought the characters and the sex and then Whoopi Goldberg brought the ghetto poetry.
Yeah.
And then Lily Tomlin brought the play. And then
she was old school. That's probably the beginning of it right there, really, right, Lily?
Yeah, Lily was the one that really brought it. And then I took something from everybody and created my own hybrid, which was the autobiographical play that you did yourself and I played all the characters in it.
Right.
You know, and that was what I brought to it.
Yeah, no, for sure. I was watching. You remember, just to go back for a second, you remember when Spalding, he would always have this huge book that he'd hardly ever look at, like stuff that he'd written, but he turned the pages, but he never fucking looked
at it. So fast, because you know he couldn't have read it that fast.
Oh, my God.
But he needed that. It was his crutch. You know, everybody's got, you know.
Oh, definitely. Yeah.
Something to lean on.
But did you remember, like, you know, there was also that other world of performance art that was just fucking out there. I mean, you probably saw that too because you were young and it was still happening, like Karen Finley.
Oh, no, I was there.
And like, who was the guy that used to cut himself? Athey.
Right. There were all those really interesting, odd, pushing the envelope kind of stuff. I was with them.
Yeah.
You know, I'd be warming up with them. Yeah. They'd be naked and doing their thing and smacking themselves on the head with the concrete walls. And then I go up next and I got to do my little story.
They were probably relieved by the time you got up there.
They didn't know what the hell. I mean, I was the oddball. It was like when you watch the Munsters and Marilyn's the normal one.
Yeah.
That's what it was like. But they thought she was ugly. Yeah.
So what was it that, like, what was the show that really made you realize that you could do what you wanted to do? Was it Bogosian?
I think it was Lily. It was Lily, man. When I saw Lily, I was like, that's me. That's what I want to do. I've been doing something like it, but this is what I want to do. But I want to put my, just make it about my life.
Right.
Make it personal. And I added costumes to it. I had more of a through line.
Right.
And then, you know, it became sort of this crazy hybrid that, you know, everybody else started borrowing, you know, Billy Crystal used it and Lane Stritch.
So what was the, how did it work? Did you write mostly on stage or did you write on the page first?
It's a combo. So I'll write it all out. And then a lot of improv, a lot of rewriting, improv.
Right. So you record it or no?
Record. I can't watch myself because then I start to hate myself.
But not even on tape?
No, I can't even stand to hear myself.
Still?
No, I can't. I have to like just be in the moment and write it and just
I'm the same way, man. I mean, I'm the same way. I can't. Like, I'll record, you know, I've recorded shit forever. I got boxes of fucking tapes.
I don't listen to it,
but I have it.
Hell no.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's impossible.
But that's interesting. It's an interesting process. So you make notes, then you go riff it out. And ultimately what happens is over repetition, you find the groove you want to keep.
Right.
And then you're in it.
And then later on what I found out was when I hit my 300th show, it's when it's gelled.
300?
That's when it's finally gelled. Oh, yeah.
Holy fuck.
Because you know, it's a massive undertaking. It's 2 hours of my own personal life. And personal life does not fit in a three-act structure. It just doesn't naturally fit in. So it's a really painstaking thing to make it a three-act structure. So that's the difficulty of it. And it's got to be mad funny.
Right.
It's got to be mad moving. And it's got to, you know, because my life's not that fascinating. So it's more about my execution than it is about my fascinating life. Because that's the only two types of one-man shows there are. It's like either you have a crazy, incredible life and you just tell it, or you're an incredible storyteller and your life's okay, you know?
It's so weird how everything is fragmented now, because like the type of one-man show that you did, I mean, they happen occasionally. I mean, maybe they'll happen again after the fucking plague. But, you know, it seems like, you know, TED Talks and all these other outlets have really kind of hijacked the sort of purity of the type of theater that you were doing. You know what I mean? Because now people,
right.
You know, now all of a sudden you hear about this TED Talk and people are like, that's the best thing I've ever seen on stage.
Yeah.
It's like, what the fuck? You know, like it used to be like there was only a handful of guys doing this shit and women, you know, and it was special. But now it seems like everyone can do it now. And either
it's still different. It's still different. I mean,
sure. I know.
I know. Latin History for Morons, the way the audience felt, especially obviously if you were Latinx, I mean, the emotions that were going through people was so intense. I could hear it on stage. I could hear people gasping. I could hear people moaning. I could hear people sobbing quietly just because of all the pain that I drudged up, you know what I mean? And I knew it because I felt it when I was doing the research, how much pain I felt at the psychosocial erasure of Latin people, you know, because we're like the largest minority in this country, largest ethnic group, you know, we're almost 70 million Americans in this country, including my undocumented Latin brothers and sisters. We're the largest voting bloc, 32 million registered voters, 73% Democratic. We're 30% of the public schools in the nation. We're 50% of the population in LA, equal to whites in New York City in population, and less than 3% of the faces on camera, less than 2% of the faces behind the camera, less than 1% of the stories being told. The smallest represented ethnic group in children's picture books. How sad is that, that a child can't even see himself reflected back in a positive way?
Yeah.
Can't find himself in a comic book, can't find himself in a picture book, can't find himself. How does that child project himself into the future?
Yeah.
That's psychosocial erasure. That's how we Latin people have come from, you know, and we continue to thrive and survive. We contribute $1.3 trillion to the U.S. economy every year. If we were our own country, we'd be the 10th largest country in the world, bigger than England. Our women are number one in small business creations at 87%. We saved the housing market at 68% last year. God damn it. Give me my equal opportunity. Give me my equal share of the fucking box office.
Of representation.
Yes.
Yeah, I thought that was an interesting line because it's like it was sort of a throwaway line in the new movie in Critical Thinking, the film that you directed. But like, you know, I was sort of hung up on when you said that these textbooks are written in Texas. You know that
is true.
I know it's true.
I make that up.
No, I know, but like there is a control. Like, you know what you're saying, the systemic racism. It also has this profound effect on the Latino community. You know, it's brown people in general, and that what the information these kids are getting in public schools is incredibly limited by design. And
absolutely.
Yeah, and I thought that was
control. It controls power. It controls.
Yeah.
Who if the hunter gets to tell the story, you're never going to hear the lion's side.
Right.
You know, and we land people happen to be the lion's side because we didn't just get here. We've been here for 500 years. We discovered America. We found it. We built it. The British took it from us. The Americans took the Southwest. And before that, we were indigenous empires, the biggest in the world. Incas, Mayas, Aztecs, Comanche, Apache. And we're still contributing.
Well, I'm sorry. I lived in New Mexico when I was a kid. And so I apologize.
Oh, my God. New Mexico. I love New Mexico. Yo, it's all Democrat.
No, it's beautiful. I was just there.
Beautiful place.
I grew up in Albuquerque. I just went up to Taos for 4 days just to hang out and clear my fucking head, man. I can't take this
shit.
That's
what everybody does out there. Everybody's always go to Taos to clear their head.
Yeah. I didn't realize it was such a thing. When I was a kid, we'd go ski there, but I never went as a grown-up. It's the first time I went as a grown-up, and it was like, holy shit, this is beautiful. Yeah, when
you
I grew up-
clear-headed.
Right now, I'm all right. This morning wasn't great, but...
No, for nobody, for anybody, trust me.
Yeah.
I didn't have towels, but I still wasn't clear-headed.
Yeah, But when I grew up, I think Albuquerque was like 60 or 70% Chicano. And it was like, it was just...
Oh, wow.
It was just, that was what it was, man. You know, I knew, like, I love when he said, I was watching one of the oldies that I think I was watching Spick and Ramen. Didn't you have a friend named Chewy?
Yeah. You must have had some Chewy.
There were some Chewies, man.
Yeah.
But that was usually because their last name was Archuleta. So it was Chewy.
I love that name, Chewy, man. It's such a dope name.
It's great.
Such a Chicano flavor, yeah.
For fucking sure, man. There's a Coke dealer who used to sell at the Comedy Store named Chewy. He used to wear a bowler hat, had a big black jacket. Chewy.
Right. The little Chicano
Chewy,
look,
man.
The homie look.
Yeah.
You know, the word homie comes from Chicano brothers in jail asking, what hometown are you from? Are you from my hometown? Are you my homeboy? That's where the word homeboy comes from.
Oh, no shit. It was weird when I was growing up because, like, you grew up on the East Coast, so the
it's
kind
a little
of
different. Yeah.
The spectrum of Latin is different. Like, where I grew up...
Yeah, it's more Caribbean.
Yeah, where I grew up is all, you know, Mexican Latinos. And I was in high school when the shift from... I think you're a little younger than me. I don't know. But I was in high school when the shift from disco to cholo happened. Like... You know, like 77, you know, everyone's wearing leather jacket, platform shoes, feather hair, you know, but by 1980, fucking button up flannels, you know, chinos, white t-shirt, bandanas, like everything fucking shifted.
What do you think that was? What do you think that was? What do you think?
I think it was a movement in, you know, claiming Latino identity. I think political.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, I just think it was sort of it was some sort of reaction. I'm sure there's somebody that knows better than I do, but you know, the lowrider thing. I mean, I saw the transition. There was a time where, you know, it was just like, you know, leather jackets and feathered hair and, you know, the fucking bell bottoms and shit. And then all of a sudden, the cholo thing happened. It was like it was definitely activism.
Yeah, but you know, that's the same thing that was happening here. Although, you know, this side is definitely much more Caribbean and obviously Colombian, Cuban, Puerto Rican, Dominican, and Ecuadorians and Peruvians, we got a lot here too. But that happened to, I remember that late 70s too, like it was the disco scene, everybody three-piece suits and...
Yeah, right, yeah.
And then all of a sudden everybody started getting hip-hop, you know, it was the birth of
hip-hop
in New York City too, you know, in the BX. And everybody started changing, you know, everybody started wearing baggy clothes.
Right, same shit.
Baggy t-shirts.
Yeah.
You know, the baseball hats.
Everyone got a little harder.
Yeah. A little fronting.
Right. And it was totally a different vibe and less, you know, less cocaine, more weed, more guns, you know?
Oh yeah. It got a little tougher. Yeah. It must've been also linked up to stagflation because that's also when that happened. You know, the country was in terrible inflationary, dire straits, you know?
Right. Yeah, man.
And the economy was bad. And, you know, and obviously the people who suffered the most are always black and brown people at the bottom.
And that's where you kind of, I mean, that is the pop culture that you grew up in.
Oh yeah. I mean, disco to hip hop, that was my life. Trying to break dance, had my cardboard box that, you know, I could barely spin, rip my hair out of my head. Almost dislocated my neck.
When I broke
dance, I broke things. That's how that came out.
So did you ever get the hang of breakdancing?
I just look better for wear.
No, you do. You look good, man. You're holding up. You're holding up. You really are.
Brown don't frown.
It was weird. Can you watch your old shit? Because I decided, I watched the new movie, Critical Thinking, which I liked, and I thought it was a noble undertaking to sort of share the story of those kids. Because, really, kind of, disenfranchised,
noble,
poor.
Noble? What do you mean, noble?
Well, I mean...
sounded condescending.
I'm sorry. No. I mean, to celebrate, you know, the underdog, and to celebrate the underdog, you know, in a sort of economically compromised way. These aren't characters you see all the time. So I meant noble it was good. You know,
Thank you. It was an important film for me because, you know, I love these feel good movies, and I think they're really important for us to have much more positive images of Latin people than negative. Because then you know, it leaves us vulnerable to demonization, like what happened in El Paso, where they shot 23 innocent Latin people just being Latin during shopping in the mall.
Yeah.
So, you know, and, you know, hate crimes are up against Latin people. Every other group is down except Latin people.
Jews up. Jews are up.
Not as much as Latin people. But we don't want to compete for that. That's not...
We're winning.
It's not
Jews.
A good time to be Latin and Jewish.
Yeah.
Which are my kids. They're both. They have both.
Oh, really?
Yeah. My kids are half Jews. Little Jew-ricans.
Right,
it's a beautiful mix. It's a great mix.
No, for sure. Yeah. So... You thought it was important to tell the story. It's sort of like, it reminded me of those movies like Stand and Deliver.
My favorite movie ever, man. I love that flick.
Yeah.
Because it was inspiring to me, like, as a young man to see that and go, sorry about that.
That's okay.
As a young man to see that, it was so inspiring to me. It was like, oh my God, we can do great things. We can be mentors. We can uplift. To follow in those footsteps is such an honor for me, you know? And I found this story of five Latin and Black kids from the ghettoest ghetto in Miami, Overtown, that in 1998, this teacher, Mary Martinez, made them regional champs all over Florida, kicked ass everywhere. And they had no supplies.
In chess.
And then state champions, and then took them all the way to national champs in America. They won.
Yeah.
They won.
Yeah. And it's like it's a great underdog story because it breaks stereotypes, and you know you're able to play you can play these kids who are sort of like they're stuck in that world of trying to front a little bit, but they're innately intelligent and kind of nerdy, and they're chess geeks,
right?
But they still live in this world of you know, hardened criminals and poverty, and you know, I always like seeing that you did that in. Spikorama too. I mean, the narrator of Spikorama, you know, was a nerdy kid, and you don't make these associations all the time. Is that being part of the stereotype? And there's a vulnerability to it built in that is very you know, engaging and endearing. You know,
right, because there's a lot of ghetto nerds and a lot of gifted kids in our communities, street intellectuals.
Yeah,
they exist. I mean, that's what America doesn't understand, that, you know, they're. There are millions of gifted kids in these communities that just never get to shine, never get, you know, tapped on the shoulder by somebody, never get mentored, and they, you know, wasted lives and wasted dreams.
They get just, you know, steamrolled or bullied or turned out by criminal culture. But I know, I mean, I was like, you know, I was ignorant. I didn't know there were Black nerds until maybe 8 years ago, you know, and it was so ridiculous, even with the existence of Urkel. So what did, I just watched that documentary just by coincidence on Wynn Hanman. And he seemed like an impressive guy that seemed to have some impact on you. Is that right?
Oh, yeah. You know, he just passed of COVID.
I know.
2 months ago.
98.
Yeah, incredible. What a national treasure he was. And he was inspirational to me, to Eric Bogosian, to Denzel Washington, Alec Baldwin, all these great actors studied in his class. And he was instrumental in my beginnings. I brought Mama Mouth to his class, and he got a kick out of my crazy ass doing all these costumes and doing all these crazy characters. And he would talk to me like he was interviewing, like he was David Susskind or something, talking to my characters. And I would, and we would have these weird conversations that the class would kind of be amused by. And then eventually I had these five characters and he put it up in his theater. I mean, he didn't really put me up in his theater. He didn't totally believe in me because he put me in the hallway and I had to be done before the main stage show. And they had a platform and 70 fold up seats that they would get rid of before the real show.
Oh, so this was at the American Place Theater? The
American Place Theater. And then the Frank Rich Review came out and then boom, the house was full of Sam Shepard, Arthur Miller, Olympia Dukakis, JFK Jr. It was incredible.
To come see you?
Yeah.
Well, let me just go back. So you first started doing it in his class. So how do you go to an acting class and say, I want to take up the whole class with my five characters? I mean, yeah, why him and what got you there?
Yeah, that's the beauty of him. He was okay. I don't think any other teacher in America would have been okay, but we only did one character at a time, to be fair. So yeah. One character per class was allowed.
Oh, okay.
So the next time I either bring it back or bring a different one. And that's how we built it in his classroom.
Because it seems to me that between you and Eric, he was sort of instrumental in helping this form exist.
Yes, he was instrumental in it, absolutely, because he believed in it. He loved it. I guess he was really old school, and he knew everything about every play. Noel Coward, Eugene O'Neill, Sam Shepard, whatever play you threw at him, he knew about it and knew how to make it work. He was a master.
Yeah. And did he help you connect it all through a story, or was that you?
Well, that one was everybody was connected geographically, not so much story wise. It was only two or three tiny little links.
Oh,
they were more separate.
Yeah.
But they were just in the same neighborhood and they heard about each other.
Yeah.
Then when I got to Spikorama, it was a family.
Right.
And that's why that one became much more connected, because they were all talking about a wedding that they were going to. It had a little bit of a Rashomon technique.
Yeah. It was it holds up, you know. It was funny. I mean, I watched it last night. I like to do that sometimes when I talk to dudes that have been around for a long time, or women, where it's just sort of like, you know, I wonder what they were like when they were kids. And you're like, oh, there's video of it.
Yeah. You got footage.
Yeah, a lot of footage of them as kids. Yeah. You can't watch that shit. When was the last time you watched that stuff?
Oh, No. I don't. Why would I watch it? What's the point of that? I'm moving.
You know why I do it? You know why? Like, I know, but like, you know, I've done it because they're in my mind. You know, sometimes as a performer, I think like I don't even know who that guy was back then.
Right.
But then like you watch it, like I watched shit from 1989 on Evening at the Improv. And I thought like I didn't have no voice. I didn't have no point of view. I didn't know who I was. And then I watch it.
I did.
Yeah, I was me. What the fuck was I thinking? Why was I so hard on myself? You know?
Right. That is the. I think the point of it is you go back and you look at yourself, damn, I was so brutal on myself. I used to pound myself and go, I wasn't as bad as I thought. Because even though you're winning awards or you're on Broadway or whatever, getting Emmy nominated, you still don't believe it. You know what I mean? You're still whoever you are to yourself. Even though you're holding an award, it doesn't really change how you look at yourself. It doesn't really. It didn't change me. I mean, I was still the same guy, even though I was nominated. I was like, I'm still me. I've still got my demons. I still, you know, I'm always like, it's extra hard.
That demon's so fucking weird, though, that one. You know, it's like, do you know where it came from?
Well, obviously, yeah, tough childhood. My dad was incredibly hypercritical. So, I know where it comes from. I've been in therapy all my life.
Really?
I paid for that knowledge. Thousands of dollars.
But he was hypercritical, but not physically abusive?
Both. Yeah, both.
Oh, yeah.
There was a lot of that. Thank God for the physical abuse, because it made me really hate authority and made me really disconnect from him. So that was a good thing.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I try to do that, too, where, you know, my dad, you know, he was a raging monster. And you sit there and try to separate, like, I must have got a couple of good things from him. You kind of make
it's too much work. It's too much work to tease out the good. I'm sure there's some good, but fuck that.
The best you can get is like, he was charming with strangers.
Yeah. He was great when he was drunk. Yeah.
Right. But you you got peace around that shit?
Oh, yeah. I think so. I've been in therapy since I was 17. I was made to go to therapy in high school because I was that problem child that wouldn't let teachers teach class. So
what, busting jokes?
Either I was expelled. Huh?
Making jokes?
Yeah, cracking jokes.
Yeah.
Practical joker, you know, locking teachers out of the room. Stuffing the water fountains, keeping teachers in elevators.
Wow.
All kinds of good fun stuff.
Sound like you had a whole list of things. So they.
Oh, yeah, no. I had a whole program.
So they forced you into therapy.
Yeah, which was great. You know, obviously I was incredibly resistant to it.
Yeah.
Because I was 17, and what 17-year-old guy wants to be in therapy talking about their problems with a stranger? But eventually it was like I started to realize the good of it, you know, and how it started to flip my whole perspective of life and the self-sabotaging.
Right.
And self-destructiveness started to like, oh, I'm undoing myself. I didn't realize. Yeah.
What the fuck is that one? You know, like I'm trying to figure out if I've got a handle on that. Why do we self-sabotage and self-destroy? Because, you know, we assume we're shit because of whatever we were told. So we honor that narrative.
Yeah, yeah. Because we're comfortable with that narrative. We know that narrative.
Right.
It feels familiar. We think it's love.
Right.
But it's not. Yeah.
Right. Oh, man.
And you continue it till you break it and you go, the world's not doing that to me. I'm doing it and perpetuating it.
Right. It's all inside job.
Right.
But you never got, you like, but what was your primary means of self-sabotage? You weren't a drug guy, were you?
No, I wasn't a drug guy. That was not my thing. It was just, I guess, just hostile and aggressive, very aggressive.
Right. Yeah, you were
an
asshole.
And always making fun of people. Yeah, kind of. When I was funny, I wasn't. And then when I missed, yeah, that's it. That's how you measure it. That joke worked. That one, you're now an asshole.
Yeah, that one, that lady's crying. Okay.
Exactly. Yeah, people from high school still say, I remember the time you made me cry. And I'm like, I'm sorry. I'm always apologizing.
Yeah. Well, it's like that bully thing. You know, you got a parent that's a bully. You're going to have a little of it in you and you got to kill it.
Yeah. Basically, you do. You got to snuff it out.
Now, when you started doing what was it like? Like in that, I mean, we're going back, but I mean, to have Sam Shepard, Arthur Miller. Because like in a lot of ways you were.
John Malkovich. Did I finish? Raul Julia.
No, they all came
George
on.
George Plimpton, remember him?
Yeah, the same night.
It was only 70 seats. Come on, it was the tiny. I wasn't in the real stage. I was in the hallway. I had to be done by 8 o'clock because it was a real show coming up.
Yeah.
But when the Frank Rich Review came out, all these people came to the show.
To the little show.
To the tiny little show.
Yeah.
Maybe they were gonna go to the main show and they got there early. I don't know. It could have been that too.
No. Frank Rich is a smart guy. I like reading that guy. Is he still around?
Oh yeah, but he's much more political. He did a great article a couple of years back on Roy Cohn. Mm. That was unbelievable in New York Magazine.
Did Roy Cohn come see you? He probably did.
I don't think so. I don't think I was his flavor.
Did Trump come?
No. I don't think he likes art.
Yeah. I don't think he likes anything.
I saw him in the clubs. I always used to see Trump in the clubs. He was at every premiere, at every club.
Yeah.
Always scouting for talent, if you know what I mean.
Sure. Yeah. Oh, you mean in the dance clubs and shit?
Dance clubs, premieres, any party, any big party. He was always there.
That's the funny thing about people who've been in New York their whole life. That clown has been around forever.
Ever. We knew he was a clown. I mean, that's the thing. You always like, you know, there's that guy. He's always. And then he's like, you know, scouting.
Yeah. I remember being on Conan O'Brien, and he was the first guest, and I was the second guest. And, you know, the segment producer, Frank Smiley, you know Frank?
Oh, I know Frank. I know Frankie forever. Yeah.
So Frank says, he comes into my dressing room. He's like, you want to meet Trump? And I'm like, you know what? I don't. Like, I knew then. I'm like, what am I going to say to that fucking guy? Like,
what do you got to say to him? And you got nothing in common.
Yeah.
You knew he wasn't rich.
He's a creep. He was just a creep, you know?
Right, basically. That's why we all knew in New York City. That's why when you saw The Apprentice, you didn't believe it. You knew it was all made up. It was a sitcom, God. Basically.
It's such a fucking nightmare. So did you talk to any of those people, though? Did you become do you have peers?
Oh, yeah. Well, because I realized that there was only one exit out.
Uh-huh.
So as soon as I was done, I would run outside to the backstage door and go to that front door and be at that door as they were walking out, and they'd have to talk to me. And they had to say something nice, because you can't be mean if you meet me right up front.
Right.
And Arthur Miller was so tall, man.
Really? Now,
he's a big, lanky dude.
Big, lanky Jew.
And Sam Shepard's a tall, lanky. It was like, God, to be a playwright, you got to be tall and lanky. Yeah. I'm going to have to work extra hard.
Did they say anything to you that resonated or it meant anything? Or did you end up being friends with them?
They were generically positive, so yeah, right, that was cool. Right. I just took it. It was nothing real specific that they gave me.
Who was your director on a couple? You work with Spike,
Peter Askin.
Peter Askin's your guy.
Yeah, we used to be really tight, Peter and I. I mean, I guess life takes you to different paths. Man. I still got a lot of great love for Peter.
And what about Spike? You work with him on a show and on a movie.
Yeah. Oh, Spike's the best, man. I mean, I feel like when we did Summer of Sam, I just felt like I really got to a whole new level in my acting, because he just creates this safe space for you to do like whatever.
Yeah.
And I did whatever, and Mira and Adrian. I mean, the performances from everybody it was the first time I went to Cannes. We went in Cannes Film Festival together.
Yeah.
So exciting.
Yeah. And like over time, like you work all the fucking time. So what determines, like I watched some of Casualties of War. No, I didn't. I watched that Brian De Palma documentary, and but that you were like 12 when you did that. I mean, that was
basically,
but that was like one of your first jobs, right?
My very first film job. It was incredible. Here I am with Sean Penn and Michael J. Fox.
Yeah.
And we're in Thailand for 6 months, and we had to go to boot camp, real boot camp, like with poisonous snakes and with all the equipment, like equipment, the weight of it.
Right.
It was brutal.
And so like when you do acting, which you seem to do constantly, and you've worked with a lot of big people over the years, I'm sure people that you're big fans of, how do you make your decisions? You just, in terms of what you're going to do.
Well, usually it was always like something challenging to me that didn't feel boring or corny.
Yeah.
And since Hollywood wasn't for me, I didn't have to play any of their games. So I just did what I wanted, and I didn't care. So it was like, the clown in Spawn, something really insane and power that was fun for me.
Right.
Tu Huang Fu.
Yeah.
With Wesley and Patrick, which was a blast. And then Moulin Rouge with Baz Luhrmann,
Oh, yeah. Yeah, it's interesting that you run these two worlds where, you're a huge star with on Broadway and stuff, but you'll do supporting roles. You'll do, TV work. I mean, you're a working actor.
Oh, I like to work, and I like to work on my craft, and I like to, you can't stay at the top of your game if you're not playing. I mean, like if you're a tennis player and you don't play for a year, your game is not going to be the same. Same thing with acting, I believe.
Yeah. And do you train with a coach or a teacher still?
Oh yeah. I still train with a coach. Yeah. I'm still doing readings. I'm doing readings on Zoom with Ethan Hawke and Matthew Broderick. I'm reading Waiting for Godot, keeping our chops going,
Oh really? And you do that publicly, or you just hang out with these guys on Zoom?
With Ethan, it's just the two of us Waiting for Godot. Matthew, we worked on it for a benefit.
Those guys are New York guys. So you guys friends?
Oh yeah, big time.
Well, let's talk about how this, how did this movie come together? Because this is the first time you directed a movie, right?
I directed a feature for HBO, was my first TV thing. And then I did some commercials, and this is my first independent film feature debut.
So who presented you with the story? How'd you get hooked up with the writer?
Carla Berkowitz and Scott Rosenfeld, offered me the teacher role.
Yeah.
And then I went to Miami, met with the teacher and the guys, and it was so incredible, man. Their love for each other was so beautiful. And yet they were always ribbing each other. They're always like,
because this takes place in the late 90s. So these guys are in their, 50s, some of them, right? Or 40s.
40s. Yeah. I'd say early 40s. Early to mid 40s, and the teacher, obviously, he's up there. And I just dug him, man. I did really dug their energy together. It was so incredible how he had found these guys and then cultivated them to the success. And I found that so fascinating. And then they offered me to direct it because of my passion for the project. And I was like, you know what? I think I can actually bring something to this movie. I really think I got a clue. I like chess. I had to crack the code of how do you make that exciting and visual, because it's not.
And how, you know, but, and how like, do you understand? How do you seem like you understand it in such a deep way? Like, I mean, that's an acting job. I mean, you may like chess, but did you understand it as deeply as this guy had to?
Well, I'm very mathematical, so
yeah,
I was able to break it down, and I was able to break down what how the teacher taught those kids,
right?
And so, because I'm mathematical, I was like, I grabbed all the best strategies and picked the best ones for film and then broke them down on camera.
Right.
Sometimes sometimes everybody was like, oh, they're long, but I say, I want to show how that happens, how that learning happens in a class. I want to show it. And so I did, you know, and by the end of the movie, you really think as an audience that you understand the moves, but you don't really.
No.
but I made you believe it because we had these lengthy classes where I'm showing you, you know, the first move, the second move, the third move, and why, the story behind it. Like that guy, Marcel Martinez, the real guy, when we do a blind chess, which is where you usually put a blindfold or they turn you away. And he can play up to 10 guys. In the movie, he just played five or six of us. And he doesn't see the board. We just call out. And he plays all of us at the same time.
That's a real skill that guy has?
That's his real skill. He was going to be international chess champion of the world, and he was disqualified on a technicality. They said he wasn't naturalized in time, some bullshit technicality, and he never played. He was so heartbroken and crushed by that he never played chess again.
Oh my God. Really? Mm-hmm.
Yes, true story.
That's sad. Wow. Mm-hmm. So I think, in terms of what you're saying, as a guy, you know, where we're at in our life, and your sort of kind of a passion and responsibility to somehow mentor young Latinos into believing they can find something better in life. This seems to be the natural arc from Latin History for Morons into this
Absolutely.
Movie, you know, where I have to assume that throughout your career, people have approached you and thanked you for, you know, showing them that there's another way to express
yourself.
Oh,
absolutely, absolutely. And I think that's the payoff of life when it comes full circle. You know, I'm in the August of my years.
We're not that old, are we?
When? I think we're in the August. It's not fall yet, but it's getting there. When it's winter, it's over.
Okay, all right, fine. I'll take August, yeah.
Yeah, the August of our years, you know. And then people come back and they say, you know, I write because of you. I do comedy because of what I saw you do, that you could do it. And, you know, that's the big payoff, man. That's what I wanted to do, because when I was younger, you know, you just didn't see yourself anywhere. And it was almost impossible to believe that you could do anything.
Right.
But luckily, I grew up in New York, and it was like, wait a minute. I see movies, I see comic books, I see TV. I know we don't exist there, but wait a minute. In my real life, Latin people are doing everything.
Right.
They're running things, they're running yeah. shit, they're closing deals, they're doctors, they're everywhere. But
yeah.
in the other media, we don't exist. So I knew there was a big bullshit disconnect between the real world and media.
Oh, okay.
I mean, it was just, I knew that. So that's what gave me the courage, because I go, this is real world, that's not.
That's interesting, because, you know, it's like, it just struck me just now that, you know, being somebody like who grew up like me, you know, I grew up, you know, with good, you know, with open-minded parents, progressive
yeah.
people. But because of the media that we take in, which is the only media available at that time, you do get a specific perception of the world, which was exclusionary. And it's
right.
interesting to me how, You know, when people are like, how the fuck are all these people Trump supporters? Well, that's exactly the same thing they're doing. They're feeding their brains on specific media that enforces their perception of what the world is like. But it's by choice, but it's the same propaganda.
It's a digital world where we all can live in our own bubble and never have it questioned.
But you're saying, though, is like the bubble used to be all of us, and it was exclusionary and systemically racist.
Right, right. They didn't even have a concern that they had to include us anywhere. I mean, they had no reason to include us because nobody was calling them out.
Right.
But we all felt it. I mean, everybody felt it. I mean, that's how Latin people can be demonized. I mean, that's my mission, to stop that nonsense. When I found out that Latin kids are the least represented in picture books and were 30% of the public school population across the country, I mean, that was heartbreaking to me, heartbreaking. And it's my mission to do something about it.
It's crazy. Well, thank you, though. Thanks for doing that. And thanks for making the touching movie and all the other work.
Thank you, my brother.
It's nice talking.
Thank you for having me on. Try to remember me at the Emmys next time, will you?
Hey, look, if I ever get to the Emmys again, I'll make sure to say hello, and I'll remember.
Oh, you'll be there. You'll be on all those award shows. I know you will.
Okay, buddy. Take it easy, man.
Take care of yourself and me. Thank you.
Okay, that was John Leguizamo and me talking. I feel like I just heard a sound go up. Where was that coming? Am I losing my mind now? And now I'll do some things on my guitar. Why not? It's what I do here. Monkey, La Fonda, live, fly on, feline angels.
Robinhood bietet Ihnen Zugang zum US-Aktienmarkt. Sie können Krypto zu niedrigen Kosten kaufen und verkaufen. Alles an einem Ort. Auf Robinhood. Investment- und Kryptowertedienstleistungen für EU-Kunden werden von der Robinhood Europe UAB angeboten, die von der Zentralbank Litauens als Finanzmakler und Kryptowertedienstleister zugelassen ist und deren Aufsicht unterliegt. Termingeschäfte auf US-Aktien und ETF-Token bergen ein erhebliches Risiko und sind nicht für alle Anleger geeignet. Bitte überlegen Sie sich sorgfältig, ob Investments in derartige Finanzinstrumente mit Blick auf Ihre Erfahrung, Risikotoleranz und Finanzlage für Sie geeignet sind. Beachten Sie die geltenden Beschränkungen und Zulassungsvoraussetzungen.